Our first six products we took to a school with about 150 children in Delhi, and you know, we had six products and they killed my favorite product at the time, but they were right, and kids never lie. It was such a good lesson. Kids never lie. They'll just be like, eh, ye to fika hai, or they'll be like, eh, ye mujhe achha nahi lagta. And so, you know, Made by Two Mothers is really the reality of everything that Slurp Farm does.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Direct to a Billion Consumers. My name is Arjun Vaidya and I'm your host. Today I'm very excited to have with us Shauravi Malik. Shauravi is the co-founder of Slurp Farm, a brand that has made wholesome, healthy food accessible for the modern mothers of today. It's not a coincidence that we're actually doing this on Mother's Day. Shauravi's brand came to being because of a gap that she saw and has now transformed into an enterprise. Through the website, packaging and brand, I can clearly see the passion and genuineness behind the brand and each of the products. And I'm super excited for this conversation. Thanks for being with me today, Shauravi.
Thank you so much, Arjun. You're an inspiration in the way that you have sort of run your company and where you are today. And like you said, it's great that we're doing this on Mother's Day. And I'm very happy to be here.
Awesome. So Shauravi, I'm going to start with a question that you may have got many, many times now, but I still want you to tell that story. Tell us the story of moving from the sort of corporate finance world to building a consumer brand.
Happy to chat about that. So I started Slurp Farm with Meghna, who's my work wife and, you know, best friend in this entire journey, as well as Umang, who is one of my oldest childhood friends from school onwards. So the brand is Two Mothers, and it's too long to say two mothers and a brother, but that's genesis of Slurp Farm. It was the three of us who started it. And Slurp Farm felt because we just knew that we had to do this. Around the time when we had kids and Meghna's daughter Nandita was born before my children, we sort of realized that the options available on the retail shelf were the same as when we were kids, right? And we all know the sort of knowledge we have today about food and food science has evolved. So for example, when we were children, our parents didn't understand that feeding your child so much sugar is a bad thing. There just wasn't information about it. So it felt strange that, you know, Megha and I, when we first met, we were in London and the elite of the country are basically all importing food from abroad or making it at home. That's broadly the two sides of what we saw happening. And all our friends were asking us to bring things back. And that's not going to work for the average Indian family, or, you know, families where parents don't live in joint families or both parents are working. And that's really where we felt the need in our own lives. But I'll rewind a bit, okay, to share the work experience that shaped my first decade of work and talk to you about that journey or the switch, as you say. I used to work at JP Morgan in London, where I worked in the M&E team and the leverage finance team, which basically means buying and selling companies and also arranging debt for them. And the first change that came from that career was when, you know, after the 2006 and 7 banking crisis and around 2010, I felt this itch to do something else, to get some operational and also investing experience. And I moved to the Virgin Group, which gave me both. I moved to this small little holding company, which manages Sir Richard Branson's personal equity stakes in his various investments. And, you know, quick flashback, that entity is like a little venture capital fund with a very patient capital horizon. It was the first time I actually, before starting Slurp Farm, witnessed that very narrow odds of entrepreneurship actually succeeding. Because when I walked in there, the first thing I had to do was close down many small businesses that hadn't made it in the portfolio. And this experience taught me so much. And I was on the boards of some of the smaller companies, which would have been called failures, right, in a more traditional setting. But they were just seen as part and parcel of supporting the spirit of venture, right, which is what the journey that all of us are a part of, and you know, the story of your podcast in some way. And to give you an example, it was like an office where one day someone would be like, I want to go on an expedition to the bottom of the Mariana Trench, which is the deepest point in the ocean, to, you know, this constant virgin space journey to Mars, to Hyperloop, and all sorts of ideas. And I would say this was the phase when, while I was at Virgin, there were so many ideas bouncing in my head every day. And also the sense that the world can and should build businesses which are truly a force for good. And around this time, Meghna had also moved to Delhi, and she had started the public health practice at McKinsey India. And we realized basically that many friends were asking us to bring back food for their kids. And at the same time, Meghna from her job was seeing that health outcomes on both ends of the spectrum were very poor. Poor kids and well-off kids both had appalling nutrition outcomes. And so when she had her own daughter, she was like, you know, we really need to do this. If not us, then whom, right? And from day one, one of my first memories of conversations with Meghna was her statement that she said, you know, let's build a wildly successful company, change how children eat, both those with money and eventually those on the other end of the spectrum. And I guess it's daunting to say this because you don't know when you're in the journey with your first company will survive. But I have learned from Virgin the value of audacious goals and fast tracking to real life. And now starting Slurp Farm, right? We basically went about visiting hundreds of small factories, manufacturers, vendors, food scientists, labs. It was like doing a mini PhD in food. We had no background in food and, you know, certainly no background in coming from business families. And even unlike today, actually, at that point, and I say this was maybe 5-6 years ago, there was no infrastructure around helping brands like ours. So I remember one meeting in particular where the first time we learned that all the butter cookies in the country largely have no butter at all, but in essence, right? So that made us make a butter cookie, which is, I mean, a completely unviable product in terms of pricing at what we priced at. So we had to close it down. But we spent the early years learning what really goes into food and also learned what we wanted to do differently and do better. And it was a time of immense learning. We really tested with a lot of people. Our first product, you know, we thought we would make a fruit puree. It was going to be exported from the UK to India, and we had found the perfect person and the machinery to then eventually make the same product in India. We'd done the branding, everything, and then we tried the products on our kids and our friends, right, and their children. We realized it just wouldn't work in India. And to date, nobody has been able to scale a fruit or vegetable puree product in India for children. It just doesn't work with our food traditions and the price points. So basically, we learned that the same options that work in the West cannot be copied here, but there is a need. We went back to the drawing board, and I'd love to tell you a little bit more about that. But, you know, from the very start, Slurp Farm was born actually in Umang's kitchen and also from the ideas in my kitchens. And we've worked really hard on our brand identity being so distinctive and memorable. There are 7 Indian animals in the Slurp Farm, but the brand can belong on any shelf anywhere in the world. And we today retail on several major marketplaces and offline stores in about 10 cities in India. All of that stuff has happened, right? But at the core of it, we make food like we would make in our own homes and own kitchens for our own children. And that's our promise as a brand.
And you know, Shaurvi, honestly, for me, when I was going through your website as well, I think the purpose came out very clearly to me. And you know, as someone who built a business behind the purpose of taking my grandfather's legacy forward, I think that that's something which really sort of drives in the back end of the business to really make it strong. So I saw on your website, it says made by two mothers. I also noticed it says made like at home and recipes from our grandmothers. So tell us about, actually, you've told us about the first few product ideas that didn't work, but tell us how you came up with eventually the first few products that you launched.
So, you know, all of our recipes actually start in some way at home. And the first ones were our grandmother's recipes. So I told you we wanted to launch this puree product. And that door started to close, but we realized, interestingly, that the real answer lay in our own home. So Meghna grew up in Bangalore and my mother is Karnataka. So millets have always been a core ingredient for our families, right? And when Nandita was born and Meghna's party shared a Sattu Mavu recipe, which is like it's a porridge recipe. Okay, and it's got lots of like different ingredients in it, and we realized that you couldn't find it on a shelf. You had to painstakingly make it. And actually, to be honest, when we made the first version of it and it used to come in these candy pouches, we hadn't actually done it correctly. We didn't learn the food science behind it until much later, I would say. And that's when we got it right. And I would say that we realized there was not enough food options with millets on the shelves. That was our understanding. We didn't make the perfect product in the first instance. And this, at that point, that started a deep dive into the world of millets. So we decided to make millets yum. Because Meghna was like, you know, my mother used to feed me millets. I don't know if you know what a ragi mudde is or like these ragi, which used to be like, they're awful. We have to make millets tasty. So one of the first products was actually a chocolate ragi cookie. And also the first few cereals. Our first few cereals had millets, I would say, but I think we have really understood how to make millets taste good, you know, in the last few years. And we also deep dived into the world of millets and commissioned the white paper on millets, which looked at all of the primary research. And this primary research goes from Berkeley to Cambridge to, you know, to the very amazing research institutions in India working on millets to truly understand the ingredients, you know. And it's like literally you'd be reading tons of papers to get one fact of knowledge, like a fat percentage. Or understand what moisture, or understand, like, when you make a recipe, you're like, ooh, this balance of ingredients works really well. And that journey has to take some time. So while we have a recipe R&D process and a person who's really amazing in our team who works on this, the starting point of all ideas kind of been our kids. And so, you know, we first had kids, we made cereals and the cookies, then they grew up, so there was pancakes and dosas. Then on a family holiday in Coorg, my son was giving my husband and me a really hard time. He was like, I'm never allowed to eat this XYZ chocolate cereal. Please, I'm on holiday, can I do it? So that sparked the puffed cereal snack we make, which basically doesn't have maida in it, has a lot less sugar than most other cereals and doesn't have like these gooey gooey centers and things like that. It's just it's a good snack for a child to have in the morning. And so we, you know, after that have done a range of superfoods that we love to eat at home. And during lockdown, our cake range was born because as a working mom, my own kids were sitting at home and baking all these maida cakes, and that was really bugging me. So I would say that the ideas always spark this way. And I'm sure over time it might evolve, and, you know, when you're a, whatever, 20-year-old company, you have a process behind things, right? And I love putting process into things. But in the early days and today, it has always been lots of kids and parents trying every product. Our first six products, we took to a school with about 150 children in Delhi. And, you know, we had six products and they killed my favorite product at the time. But they were right. And kids never lie. It was such a good lesson. Kids never lie. They'll just be like, eh, ye to fika hai. Or they'll be like, eh, ye mujhe achha nahi lagta. And so, you know, Made by Two Mothers is really the reality of everything that Slurp Farm does. And I want to underscore how important that is. Like, I met someone who owned a really actually awesome food brand, but he very emphatically said, I don't eat the products my company makes. I am diabetic. And that way of making food has just got to change. We have more knowledge today, and it's 2021. We know so much in the middle of this pandemic, right, about food and health outcomes. As a brand, we will always stay true to this. And, you know, there's Ayurveda, there's yoga, and there's millets. India has so much to give to the world. And 2023 is the year of millet. You know, the UN has taken this on, but it's basically up to us, right, to really, really bring this to life.
And I think the thing that you said about sort of taking what is Indian to the world is something that resonates with me a lot. But I think another very interesting thing you said is that your business and your product range actually scale as yours and Meghna's kids grew up as well, right? And I think that's really interesting. But I had another question, right? Because I think for you, the genuineness and the made like at home is very important. So as you scale from a project to an enterprise, how do you maintain this consistency with your message of being healthy and wholesome while still really operating at scale?
That's a really good question. And I would say that given our backgrounds, right, we kind of had that thinking from the start, in that we didn't want to do anything that was not going to have outsized impact, because you can't move nutrition outcomes, right? If you're basically feeding your kids and your friends' kids, that's great. And I enjoy that process a lot, but I'm not going to be able to change if I don't provide a solution at scale. So I cannot give up that fundamental sort of value system. And we had a few rules from the start which have really helped us. We don't do short shelf life of fresh products, because there's too much moisture in them, and you can't actually, you have to then, as a young company, you have to get sort of supply chains right, and or you have to make compromises, right, in terms of what you put in the product, and we don't want to do that. So our products are our grain mixes, which have shelf life, but you don't have to add any preservatives or junk food. We don't enter niche categories, because you have too much education to do with a like uber healthy, you know, health product. You cannot create that equation. So we go after large categories like kids snacking, breakfast, superfoods. Instead of innovating on the occasion, we're just going to give you a much better version of what people are currently eating. If we can't make a much better product at 25-ish% higher cost, 30%, we don't make the product. because we want to be a mass brand. The idea is that as we grow volume, we should be able to do that price differential to incumbent. And I would say that digital has helped us sometimes to say, okay, we'll do a better natural sugar, which costs, yes, 3x a normal sugar, but people are willing to make that move, right? So digital allows you to do that because you're not putting that product on a retail shelf and having it go bad and sit there and not move. So that's one thing I would say we've stuck with. We don't actually use wheat in anything we make. It's not just no maida, but you know, people in India don't want to hear no wheat, and we're not trying to be a gluten-free company. We just genuinely want to get people to eat diversity of grains, and there's no trans fat in any food we make. That is an unbreakable rule. I would say that our products are starting to almost all entirely move to the no refined white sugar. When we started, actually, we tried to make a no sugar company and we failed at it. My own grandmother, like the first cookies were made with apple puree, and my grandmother was like, I'm never going to pay 200 rupees for these cookies you're making, surely. And you know, it was a flawed idea because you can't get apples in the summer months, right, from Himachal, so you won't get them in December. So that was, I would say, these rules actually came in place for that. Now, I actually think that India is now starting to get ready for this. So we are starting to slowly move. So for example, if you buy our cakes, you will get a separate sachet. You can see the sugar. And as a parent, you can decide, do I want to use less? Do I want to use something more? And it's a raw sugar, okay? So we basically have given the consumer both options, those with no sugar and those with the raw sugar, which is, we are now also changing to date sugar in some instances. So broadly, that need to maintain consistency is written into how Slurp Farm is fundamentally structured. And you know, if you today walk into a store, there is a pet food aisle, but there is no kids food aisle. And we are trying to do that. And I feel this is the right moment in time to see scale in this space. In the next 5 to 10 years, India will have 20, 30 cities, right? Like with like the US or China. And we will have that sort of population which supports these very sort of health-based, consistency-based rules. Right now, we're all scared to deploy it because we feel, where's the number, right? Can I do this? But I actually think that we will all be surprised to see how many, many, many shifts will happen in terms of the way our cities are structured. And then that population that needs these solutions will come.
I think you also said something that we had as a philosophy as well, and that's really important for everyone listening, right? You don't build products for your friends and family. You build products for much more than that. And I think that resonated with me. The other thing that you talked about was what digital allows you, right? Digital allows you to sometimes launch products which may be seen as slightly more niche, but because you don't have to be on a shop floor, it allows you to experiment a little bit. I know we've discussed this before, but you know, we were never able to crack offline, and we chose very quickly that this is not the market for us. But you've been in the offline market. So tell us about your experiences with being offline versus online, and what does a challenger or a new brand need to do to be in the offline space? What advantage do you get from that channel?
You know, so we didn't talk about it in depth, but I can hear from your voice that it must have been an interesting experience even for you, right? And I think struggling with the offline channel is like a chicken and egg problem. So as a new brand, you have low awareness. So we needed to generate that. At the same time, if we did that, like you create marketing awareness or you do a campaign and you're not easily available, right? What was the point of that massive campaign? So remember, when we were trying to scale offline, we also didn't have a D2C channel. So I would say COVID has really increased online adoption, and the experience of trying to scale offline made me learn and made Meghna learn what we will do differently and better next time. So I'm very grateful for it. We started on online marketplaces like everyone else, but I would say where we differed was that we tried to expand offline simultaneously in 2018, because Meghna and I are really at the heart of it. We were like, we want to build a big brand, so we got to do this. And towards the end of 2019, I remember sitting outside very, like it's like a picture in my head. I remember sitting outside Shanti Sagar in Bangalore, and I remember feeling like a little bit, I can't crack this. So we made this flow chart, okay? And you laugh, but it went from quantitative easing in the Western world to pension funds and investors, to emerging market funds, to challenger brands getting a lot of VC liquidity into the system, to that whole network of distributors, super stock, there's retailers, retail listings, and they're not a part of the liquidity that brands like ours have access to, right? Then there's massive field sales force at the end of the day. And it all boiled down to these insane discounts to the consumer. So I was just thinking, what do I do if I want to operate in this field of normalcy and not be like a discount brand, because I want to use good ingredients. And so how do I make this work? And I mean, the great news is kind of what I said to you before, right? That we felt if there were a few years of this plays out over time, the Indian economy would grow, consumers would change consumption habits, and all that growth that we are waiting for is coming. But it takes time to see that process through. So the realization actually that moment had was that we need to survive while this transition plays out, and we need a war chest. So in all that creative confusion that all these young brands like ours are seeing and wondering, right, there will be several iconic brands of tomorrow that get built today. It's a really exciting time to be doing what all of us are doing. And what Meghna and I realized in that moment was that this thing, right, that focus is spelled no. And food brands in particular, more than we're seeing like this personal care sort of crazy growth, but food brands take a normal timeline to scale. And I would say that COVID happened soon after, and it was like a blessing because it made us, forced us actually to take an ability to step back and act on the realization that our offline business was basically a white elephant and our online business was always profitable, like from day one. So we basically, what we did, we cut down our offline business in March last year when the lockdown happened, and two things happened. We had a really focused online strategy and our revenues tripled and we broke even. So regardless of what happens, right, we have that confidence of knowing what it takes to run our company for not a lot of money. And in the offline channel, just to get back to that, how this discussion started, right, the struggle really is to get paid. That's the bottom line struggle. And I've thought hard about this. I think that what is helping challenger brands is that the MSME Act means the marketplaces have to legally pay small vendors like us on time, like in all parts of the world, right? It's business as normal. And your D2C also means you get paid ahead of time. Now, the several retailers and distributors in the offline channel are MSME themselves. So the same chain doesn't function without friction. You don't get paid. And a systemic change needs to happen. Taking on a new brand is expensive. It is expensive for the distributor and retailer also. So it should move to a more specialized process. It should have a higher charge inherent in it, like the way it is abroad. And many changes are needed. So salaries in India are rising and they need to do so for that field sales force. We, as companies like ours, should have fewer but more qualified people, and economies of scale really need to kick in the retail segment. So I would say my end takeaway is basically from all of this was just be laser focused on your consumer and consumer and consumer, and the rest will follow.
And I think that this is the first time, and it's a very interesting take to sort of building a macro to the challenges of the offline. But I totally agree with you. I think being good at one thing allows you to be really, really good at that one thing before you explore sort of multiple different channels. So I'm gonna segue a little bit here, Shaurvi, and move into what you talked about right now, which is the customer, right? Customer. So my mom is literally the toughest customer in our family to crack. It's Mother's Day today, and she was complaining to me about a vendor as well. And from our limited experience with our Chyawanprash toffee, Chakash and Dr. Vedya as well, we saw this, right? We saw how difficult it is. So you're a mom yourself. Tell us about the experience about being a mom and catering to moms. Did it come naturally to you, or do you agree with my feedback that's a really tough customer set to crack? And what do you do to crack it?
You're right. And firstly, Chakash is a great product, by the way. So it's like, I've used it. It's a really nice idea. And I think that, you know, I would ask you something, which is that what happens when you crack the tough customer? You must have seen this play out.
Yeah, so I think it takes work, but once you crack, the customer becomes really loyal.
Yeah. So basically, when you crack the tough customer, right, you get lifelong magic and royalty. And the thing about moms, and maybe you saw this in Chakash, right? Like, if a mom discovers something and loves it, she will tell 10 people. She will tell. And that's the magic of a brand like ours. So I've always believed in the power of just staying the right course and doing the right thing. And Slurp Farm is, at the end of the day, made by many moms. It's not just Meghna, you know. So many mothers have made this their story. And it's emotional in some way because there are mothers who have helped us to sell. There are mothers who have written us the nicest of letters, which we try to reply on our own. There's very low attrition in our company when we have a truly convinced parent who comes to work. And we have many of those, you know, who are like, I'm a consumer, or I've given this to my kids. I want to come and work for you. We see nearly 50% repeat on online channels. So I think it comes from the fact that the food system is broken in parts. And a whole lot of parents have understood this and they're saying it's not okay anymore. So it is very tough to sell to parents because there is this sense of, can I trust, right? Can I take that leap of faith? But when people take that leap of faith, it is life affirming almost, and you have your own advocate. And I think that's the power of building a brand like Slurp Farm. And Slurp Farm is built on speaking to parents. And I keep saying moms, and off late a lot of dads have written to us and corrected us literally off the email saying, hey, your email always says mom. But the truth is, it is still primarily moms. And it has been really fun to do this in our own skin and voice. So much of the early growth was just word of mouth, right? And I think that I'll say one thing. You asked me about like my experience of being a mother and catering to other mothers, right? I, as a mother, do find the balancing act very hard in terms of the experience of being a mom, because work means that I spend a lot of time in an office, which is now my home. And I get energy from meeting people and doing the cooking and meeting other moms, both of which is not really happening right now. And what I used to love most was to do... Just one second, huh? One second, sorry. Sorry, that was a mom moment. I had both kids knocking at my door. I don't know if you could hear it. So I have now told them to not be knocking on my door while there's a podcast. But I think what I was trying to tell you, catching my chain of thought, was that COVID has made it hard to actually speak to parents in person. And what I used to love to do most... Are you still there, by the way? No, okay. So do you want me to tell you this answer again, this part of it?
No. Continue. I'm even going to have the part of your kids coming because it's a really nice moment.
Okay. So the truth is that, I really miss this sort of doing 2 to 3 events every month in different cities to talk to moms and understand their real issues. I miss that, and Zoom is not doing it. And the second really thing about doing this as a parent and mom myself really, right, is that I'm not the primary cook in my own house anymore. I quite like that actually, but I'm not able to do it because it's a pretty relentless work schedule and I definitely end up burning midnight oil very often. So the reality of doing this as a mom myself is that my 2021 goal is to cook more with my kids, and which is ironic given that it's also my job. But that's that parent experience of trying to build this.
And I think a lot of what you do is very personal to you, right? So I'm going to ask you another question on you specifically, right? So I moved from private equity to running my own consumer brand, and sort of other than being methodical, I had to unlearn many things. You've had the experience of being in corporate finance, then moving to a venture role. So what did entrepreneurship really feel for you like? And what did you take from the corporate world, and what do you have to sort of relearn or rejig in terms of your mentality or the way you function?
I like that question a lot. Things to unlearn, relearn. I think COVID has meant a very reflective year on personal life and leadership for me. And I'll talk about what I had to unlearn or I'm still trying to unlearn and what I did take from my work life into the journey after that. I had to unlearn quite a few things, by the way. And it is actually, it's really helped me personally to develop, skills to be running a company, to work with Meghna, who is like the yin to my yang, and Umang, who's one of my oldest friends, because you need that in some ways. And the first thing really was what I told you earlier, right? And it was the concept of doing less. And then someone said this very nice thing to me, was the whole focus is spelled with an N and an O. It's just self-explanatory. And Meghna and I are always trying to be focused on executing. It doesn't mean we don't make mistakes, but be focused on executing what really matters. And I think the second thing I had to like really, really learn again in a career sense, right, was humility, because we really didn't know anything about this new journey, and all of that past career meant nothing to the person sitting across the table. I was starting from zero without the might of this billion-dollar JP Morgan like institution. It was just our scrappy little company. I would say I really didn't understand the scale of how little I knew, and I also didn't know how many people would help us figure it out, right? But I think the other thing I had to unlearn was this whole like being busy or being over methodical, because in some ways what we learned in the entrepreneurial journey was this thing that I'm part of the EO Accelerator, and it teaches you, and they put it and they say process sets you free. So it's regularity over daily, weekly, monthly and quarterly scrum, and that routine, it has actually freed my calendar a lot. And I also try to schedule this sort of non-busy time, right, thinking time, and which is when my best ideas come. But I don't think that my early sort of career, or even for you in PE or finance, actually focuses on this kind of learning. It's always, for me, come through other entrepreneurs and talking to them. And that's a really valuable part of learning for me. And I think that what the early career did give me, I mean, JP Morgan gave me confidence, structure, as you say, and scale thinking, and leadership lessons from really the best, and this sort of language of negotiation, right? And I mean, in terms of confidence, it was just such an exciting place to walk into in my early 20s. My first ever business meeting was the CEO of Carlsberg. The confidence of several such meetings, structure and scale thinking is basically, once you see processes work in a large organization, you just know what great looks like. So even when it was just Meghna and me, we always had this sense of where we want to be, and there's still loads to do. Leadership lessons, there have been so many. Jamie Dimon is like the CEO when I first joined that first summer that I had in London, and getting to know the business. And I'll give you a small example on that, right? He used to basically, there was this urban legend that he used to stand downstairs and tell people who were misusing the taxi policy off. And I really learned that that attention to detail, right? It was so legendary, but that attention to detail is where culture is, in the small details, even for a massive firm like that. And I would say the last thing that I definitely learned was this whole ability to negotiate. And the last transaction that I did before leaving JP Morgan was a French restructuring, where I basically had to live in Marseille for half the year. There were 80 credit lines this company had, adding up to nearly about 400 million euros. And there were 32 banks and lenders in the company, and that company was about to default. Managing that consortium of lenders, because you had to make sure as an advisor to the company that they don't pull the plug and make the company go into a restructuring, right? It was the best learning experience of my life today. I learned how a CEO can and should negotiate when they have their back against a wall. And you see how things come out of a cycle, actually. That's what it taught me. So I would say that those are really war stories, right, that careers like PE and finance give you for life. And then for me, Virgin Group was also this crash course into like building a brand and seeing how a founder has woven like his heart and soul into a brand. It's not just that iconic red logo and a product. It's this impression and experience and feeling and delight and the sheer genius of PR, very clever marketing, the absolutely insane passion that it takes to build iconic brands. And I would say those are some of the things I have taken into Slurp Farm.
And you know, one thing you talked about as well, when you talked about your JP Morgan experience, was culture, right? And as we embrace this pandemic and we're all working from home, how has it been for you to run a consumer brand from home? Like, what are some things you've done to keep the culture and feeling of unity alive across the screen in the company?
I think that as a company, we have always had a very flexible approach to working. So even before COVID, we work out of Bombay, Delhi, Gurgaon, and Bangalore and Dubai. So we'd have like this sort of core offices in Delhi, Gurgaon, but the other cities we had co-working spaces, and people would, you know, if they wanted to be in an office setting with other colleagues, they would have always this meeting room and place to go to, and some people would work from home. And I would say that COVID actually just formalized how that can work, and it's working really well for our team. In terms of culture, I feel like what COVID did was give us time and the space to sit back and really codify that. So the first month after we changed all of our business, the team sat down and we read this book called Conscious Capitalism together. And when I say read together, we basically, you know, highlighted different parts of the book, and different people on the team read different parts of that book aloud to each other on a Zoom call. And we had like that starting point of a discussion of what do we really want to build Slurp Farm as, right? Because there's Meghna and my vision, but then there's also your vision needs the team to be aligned with that. And so you have to bring everybody else into your vision and translating it. And that was a really fun exercise. That was our start at codifying how will we grow and how will we keep that purpose alive for every next generation of person that comes into Slurp Farm. And I would say what I'm really proud of, and Meghna's really proud of, is that we know that clarity definitely exists within our company. And I would say it's not just us, but they're torchbearers of it across many of the people who've been at Slurp Farm, either for a long enough period now, or even some new joiners, to carry it on. Because culture really happens when you're not in the room, right? It can't just be founder-led. It has to be like when Meghna and I walk away, can people enunciate what does that mean when we're not sitting around? And I feel we're like on the right path of the journey to that. It's really exciting.
Yeah, my favorite favorite quote on branding is what Jeff Bezos said. He said, your brand is what people talk about you when you're not in the room. And I think that totally sort of exemplifies what you guys are doing. Sharvi, I'm going to move into one question on my favorite part of any consumer brand, right? And that's retention. To me, retention is sort of the secret sauce or superpower of any consumer brand, especially a brand that has some presence in the D2C space. I assume that this category that you're in is a repeat-friendly category, but can you talk to us about customer loyalty, delight, and how you look at sort of bringing customers back?
Really, really important part of building D2C businesses. We do have strong retention. We have almost 40-50% on online channels and marketplaces when we can track it. I would say, though, that it's really important to try to remind ourselves not to take that for granted. We always try to listen very closely and innovate in an agile way. And I'll give you an example of that, is that last year when COVID hit, we had to restructure our entire business overnight. Every single person in the company started doing customer calls and abandoned cart calls, right? And I think that one single effort taught us the importance of doing this always. So we have now started something called the 3C initiative, or the customer companion calls. So basically every single person, okay, from the office driver to the sales force to the accounts team to Meghna and I, we have to do half an hour of customer calls twice a month. And the customer service team leads the call, but every person in the company gets to be a companion on the call. Because the best version of our brand and service has come and will continue to come when cross-functional teams hear a problem statement and they become proactive about fixing it together. And we've been really lucky to have some very awesome mentors. So Aditya Ghosh is one of our mentors. And when we sat down and reorganized our org chart, we basically, you know, digital companies can be structured differently. So we merged all of our sales and marketing and people who see themselves in all these various silos. And we have one customer and revenue team. We exist because we have consumers, right? And we make revenue. So although we started our own website later in the journey, we've just been super focused on knowing our consumers. And I still remember when I was a kid, how Nirula sent me a postcard for my exam. And I must have been about 8-9 years old, right? But till today, every time when I eat that hot chocolate fudge, and I can't eat them that often anymore, I remember that. So the dream behind Slurp Farm is that when we're in your home, in your heart, our brand USP should make you feel fun and have this very light-hearted relationship with a very serious concept, which is eating well. But to do it in a way where you're like, oh, you know, you feel happy. When you think Slurp Farm, you feel happy. That's I would say, that would be us achieving customer retention, because once you do that, you don't have to keep trying all these like other things at it. You know you've done it.
And it's basically very simple, as you said, right? It's about being as close and listening as intently. And I remember for us, for the first 1.5 years of Dr. Vaithya's, actually, my wife and I did customer service ourselves. And that actually gave us enough insight for the rest of our journey to say, hey, we actually know these customers and we know what they want. So Sharvi, I'm going to move towards the sort of last part of this chat. And I'm going to ask you a question on fundraising, right? It's a question that a lot of people ask, and I wanted to sort of discuss that with you. So Slurp Farm has now raised more than $3 million in capital, both from an angel round as well as an institutional round from one of India's most famous consumer sector investors. And then I get a lot of questions from early stage founders about why, what, and when with capital, right? So tell us about your why, what, and when with your capital raise journey.
You know, Arjun, actually, in some ways, your example is the true celebration of this, right? It's an exit. It's not the fundraise itself, which doesn't guarantee anything. And you know this. So in our journey, we have always tried to raise money from people who have expertise in core areas. So I would say that our angel round was like a mini advisory board. And now with Fireside on board, it's really deep engagement on several core areas. And that's how we have thought about raising money. It should not be just money. It has to come with something else. And everybody has a different take on this. So for some people, it don't want sort of too much advice. And for some, the advice is important. I would say, if I were to describe the journey for you a little bit, it would be that we were bootstrapped for the first 2 years. Now, in hindsight, should we have raised institutional money earlier? Who's to say? I don't know, right? Like, your journey is your own. But we raised our first angel round in June 2018. I was 7 months pregnant when that round closed, and we raised about $1 million at that time. And a nice memory for women who might be listening, right? I remember chatting with Meghna about, should we maybe just raise later after, you know, I had given birth, because we had very reasonable operating costs. And she said something so emphatically, and it made me feel so nice at the time, even though it's my own co-founder. sound of saying it. She was just like, we don't need money from people who don't believe in us. And as a testament, right, no one in the round asked a question or said anything. That first round actually was people who had either worked with us or known us in our professional lives or really had tried the product and written to us on the customer service line. So we just had this very simple two-page agreement. And we have had investors from that first round who've come and rolled up their sleeves and sat in our office. And I'm really grateful for that. We really needed it during COVID. Right from, you know, Utsav Bejal, who introduced Meghna and me years ago and invested, to Samrat Bedi of Forest Essentials, which is one of my favorite brands, and to Ashish Dhawan and Sanjeev Bikchandani, who invested because Mrs. Dhawan tried the pancake and really liked it. That was what our first round looked like. And it was pretty typical, I would say. We made a lot of micro experiments with that money, figured out what works and what doesn't. You know, offline definitely was a lot of money burnt, right? But a lot of learning. And we also found true product market fit, thank God. So that's basically how we thought about our angel round or what happened in retrospect. And we reconnected with Fireside in March 2021 in the midst of COVID. And I think it was meant to be in some sense, you know. In 2016, before launching, we were still in bootstrap frame of mind and we met Kaval. And he just has the most incredible nose and instinct, right, for finding things, because we literally had printed out only one set of packaging. It was that early stage. I would say that Fireside has been the absolute right institutional investor for Slurp Farm. Their vision and purpose really find strong alignment. And I think that, you know, for anyone who's listening, it's really, really important to do that. And this time we closed a deal over Zoom because we had met quite early on in our journey. And I'd say at this phase, we're just in build mode. I don't know if it's useful for some of your listeners. Some of the things I would think about is that when you're talking to investors, stay in touch with some of them. I really enjoy talking to some people who we might never work with or ask for money, or they might not want to invest in us, all of that, right? But their insights are gold and their conversations will actually teach you a lot. So I personally enjoy that, and I don't look at every conversation as we have to raise money from someone. It's more, what can I learn or what can I give to the other person even, right? The second thing is that it's very important to be aligned as founders. I think the single most useful thing last year was we had a mentor who spent hours talking all of us through like an internal RASI. And that means that when you raise the money, you'll be really certain about all of the different ways that you want to spend it or how you think about that whole process. Yeah, that's fine.
I think the key, you said two things which really sort of meant something to me. The first thing you said is choose wisely, because it's a long relationship and you chose people who really believed in what you do. But I think the second thing you said, which is critical, is it's not a transactional relationship, right? So if someone invests or doesn't invest, that's not the only part of the relationship. That even if people who didn't invest with you and gave you some insights, you valued that. I think that's something that's really important, especially because I've seen it from both ends, right? From the investing end and sort of raising capital. So Shorvi, I'm going to move to the last leg of our conversation. It's just a little bit of fun. It's a rapid fire round. So you just have to say the first thing that comes to your mind when I say these things. So I'm going to start with the first question. Your favorite brand that's not Slurp Farm?
Ooh, Apple, hands down. I mean, we spend our entire day with that thing, right?
Oh, what's your go-to brand at a grocery store?
Devan's Coffee. I don't know if you ever had it. But it's not always in a grocery store, more Amazon. And Maison & Co. Chocolate. Really, I'm a mom who needs caffeine. Chocolate.
Okay, tougher one for you. Online or offline consumption?
Oh, definitely online. That's not tough at all.
Android or iOS? I kind of know the answer to this, but I'm still asking.
Android for work. So much of my day is, I have a separate device trying to look at how the UX looks on an Android phone, because that's where people are.
Makes sense. I have an Android phone as well, from all the apps that weren't available on iOS that we had to use for marketing.
Correct.
What's the app that you spend your most time on?
Oh God, WhatsApp. My team is going to laugh. They make so much fun of me.
Okay, the last one, since we can't really travel right now, which is the first place you'll go to once the world opens?
I really want to, I've been dreaming of organizing the most kick-ass offsite ever, okay? It's like, I'm really excited to do it. So it's probably going to be the first thing that I will travel for after all this lockdown ends. And I've traveled so much in my 20s and 30s, I really have no desire to run around the world for too many reasons anymore. So I want to broadly see my family and I want to see everyone at work.
I hope your team's listening. But thank you everyone else.
I've told them, I don't know if they're listening, but I've told them, and it's like we're all excited. offsite, you know? Like, I actually have a quick thing. I think the future of work might be like quarterly offsites and you continue to work from home. I don't know.
Thank you so much, everyone, for listening. And thanks, Shaurvi, for taking out the time. Until the next episode, we'd love to hear back from you on feedback, questions, or anything else. I'm available on Instagram at abvaidyan, on LinkedIn, Arjun Vaidyan. I'd love that. Also, don't forget to click the subscribe icon if you like what you heard. Please click the share button and share it with family and friends. I really enjoyed this conversation, Shaurvi, and I've learned a lot. Thank you so much for taking out the time on a Sunday, and happy Mother's Day.
Thank you. I had a great time chatting with you. Stay in touch.